The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Master Dogen's Genjo Koan. Section 3. When Buddhas are truly Buddhas, one need not be aware of being Buddha. However, one is the realized Buddha and further advances in realizing Buddha. Seeing forms with whole body and mind, hearing sounds with the whole body and mind, one understands them intimately. Yet, it is not like a mirror with reflections, nor like the water under the moon. When one side is realized, the other side is dark. Before I get into this, I just wanted to thank all of you who were so involved in helping to make the Study of One Thing art exhibit such a smashing success. It obviously required a lot of work, and particularly to Hojin Sensei for all of your beautiful work that you offered to the Sangha, and along with everything else that you contribute. I thought a lot of Dada Roshi yesterday. I thought he would have been very happy. Yeah. When Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they need not be aware of being Buddha. A tree is just a tree. It doesn't need to be aware that it is a tree, even if it could. It knows how to be a tree without knowing. It completely fulfills itself as a tree without knowing it's a tree. We have consciousness, self-awareness. And self-awareness, remember, is just an awareness of a sense of something, a sense of something, someone, ourself, who is at the center of our experience, who is speaking, who is listening, who is hungry, who is walking. And that sense of self-awareness comes and goes, right? It's not always there, but it does come and go. Sometimes it can be very pronounced, and we can kind of stumble over it. But mostly it just comes and goes. It's not a problem, it's a function of our mind, but it does create, it's one of the significant ways that it seems to create a sense of someone, because I am looking back at myself and my self-awareness. So what is it that I'm looking back at? Well, myself. And so when it arises, it's important to not hate it or love it, to not want to extinguish it or give it more life, but just treat it like it is. It's just a sense of something that comes and goes. Whatever is happening in that moment, right? Whether you're listening or walking or eating, you just bring your attention back to that one thing. And in that way, it softens its hold and doesn't really have a lot of binding effect. We do have consciousness. Without it, right? And we're rather with it, we have desires, we make choices, right? But if a tree had consciousness, could have desires, would it act badly? When a tree grows and overshadows a small sapling, right? Is it doing that to get back at that sapling? Has it got a grudge? Does it delight in giving that sapling less light? If you're teaching a class or playing an instrument or performing a dance or offering a talk, making a meal, for the most part, we don't need to know moment to moment that that's happening. When you're walking, you don't need to think, I am walking. I am walking. I am still walking. I am yet still walking. There's just walking. And so in that sense, we don't need to know, we don't need to bring in that sense of self in order for that very natural function. function to be happening and for us to be fulfilling our natural state in that moment. One moment just follows the next. One action makes the next action possible. That sense of self, of witness, of self-consciousness is not necessary most of the time. It becomes a habit, right? It can become a very strong habit. It can become a self-censoring, a self-limiting, a self-editing kind of thing. Or, of course, it can also turn the other direction, be very aggrandizing. When we're under the influence of our habits, our reactivity, our patterns of thought and emotion as practitioners, then sometimes being aware of yourself is actually helpful, right? If you've taken vows to follow the moral teachings and you realize you're not doing that, being self-aware helps you. If you sit down to practice Zazen and you want to be doing that and you become aware of your mind, self-aware that you're indulging thoughts, that's helpful. If in that self-awareness you then become heavily judgmental and self-critical, that's not helpful. So self-awareness itself is neutral, doesn't have any particular quality. It's not good or bad. It's how we respond to it. When one is not yet truly a Buddha, there are moments when we need to be self-aware. But here Dogen is saying when Buddhas are truly Buddhas, one need not to be aware. And one is the realized Buddha without knowing and continues, further advances in realizing Buddha. The path is endless. Because the sense of self is so strong and so present and so enshrined in our culture, to build it, to defend it, to make it better, to make it dominant. And because we are so accustomed to it, we can think that without that, we're not going to function. We're not going to know what to do. But the fact is we human beings have been functioning as they have been since the very beginning without a self, without any fixed and independent sense of self, without any essence. That's our nature. So having self-awareness is just a perception of something. It doesn't create that thing. And so in a sense, the evidence is right there that not having a self, we don't need to have self-awareness. So then Dogen goes on, when Buddhas are truly Buddhas, well, what is that? And so he says, seeing forms with the whole body and mind, hearing sounds with the whole body and mind, one understands them intimately. And in Buddhism, intimacy is not so much an emotional feeling of closeness. It's intimate in terms of letting go of any sense of separation, distance, gap between ourselves and any aspect, within or without. Yasutani Roshi said, in terms of this body and mind, he said, body and mind are fundamentally one. Regarding them as two is a thought, a delusion. When you are happy, is it your mind that is happy, or is it that your body that's happy? When you're hungry, is it your body or your mind that's hungry? If you say, my stomach is empty, then it must be your body. But don't we also at some moment say, I realize I'm hungry? Is that your mind? He said, it's clearly not divided, not two. He said, this whole idea of separation between body and mind is extremely frivolous. Be serious. Mind and body are always one. We can be aware we have words that speak to mind and body. And so sometimes that's very useful, right? I often think that in terms of, practice, when your heart is filled, when you have a strong sense of aspiration or bodhicitta, let's call that the mind. You experience it in your mind. And so your body just follows. And you go to sit. But sometimes that's not there. Let's say what your mind is in that moment is empty or void or feels distant from the Dharma. And so now you can lead with your body. Put your body where it needs to be. Put it on that cushion, right? Your mind will follow. And so sometimes to think of them in that way can be helpful. But much of the time, it's not helpful. What do we do when, what happens when we separate body and mind? We see them as two distinct things. Well, we've got a lot of years of evidence of that in Western culture, right? Reducing the body to a machine, right? Or reducing Zazen to something just mental. I was talking to somebody recently who's been of another tradition, who's been practicing meditation for a while and has a lot of chronic back pain. And they said that they've always thought of meditation as just a mental thing, right? They're just working with their mind, working with thoughts. And so they were in a lot of pain and it wasn't getting better. And then they read a Buddhist book on meditation and realized, oh, body and mind are not two. Meditation is not just a mental thing, whatever we might think that is, but it's a whole thing. It's a unified thing. So he finally really began to pay attention to the body and began to have very different experiences, better experiences. So when we separate within ourselves body and mind, right, we generally will elevate. I'm a mind person. That's what I do. I think. I'm good at thinking. I'm not in the body, right? Or I'm a body person. That's what I do. I'm not really that smart, right? Or I'm a creative person, or I'm not a creative person. And then what do we do? What happens when we turn that on others? You are just a body, or you are just a mind. It's just a different form of objectification, but it's a reduction, right? I mean, objectification itself is a reduction, but it's a further reduction. And so that whole living miracle of a universe we call a person starts, we start to splice up, right? And the very act of doing that reduces whatever aspect we see them as, a body, as a very small and limited thing. It's not the body. Or if we think of somebody as just being smart, they're not really in their body. We're not really appreciating the fullness of that mind. Or the mind is just a kind of thinking machine. The body just carries the mind around. That's what it does. In other words, what is it? What is the actual experience of a lack of intimacy? This is an experientially based tradition. It's got lots of teachings. We have to learn what certain words mean. There are concepts. Those concepts are actually very important. They convey very significant ways of understanding that thing that's sitting on your cushion. The person, the world that we live in, our interconnectedness. But intimacy, in a sense, is free of all of that. Not apart from it, but not bound by it either. So whether it's mind and body, whether it's sacred and mundane, realized and embodied, to realize something and then to embody it, all these different ways of splitting things up, separating them out. Right? Mizumi Roshi, Yasutani Roshi that I'm drawing from, many teachers in Western Buddhism also going back because people are people and have always been people. Sometimes practice very diligently, were very devoted to the Dharma, helped a great many people to alleviate or end their suffering, and also caused harm. Sometimes fell prey to their own desires, their own lack of embodiment of what they knew to be true, putting their own desires or wants over the welfare of their students or the Sangha. How do we do that? How do I do that? Do I always embody the Dharma? No. Do I always live in accord with what I know to be true? No. Does sometimes that happen without knowing? Yes. Is sometimes it willful? Yes. That's important, right? That's where we practice. That's where we bring our attention. that's showing us, right, to further advance in realizing Buddha. It also helps us cultivate compassion. Because if we don't, as we are recognized that within ourselves, don't meet it with compassion, but meet it with shame or guilt or anger, then that's what we're cultivating. That's not further advancing our path in realizing Buddha. And that's what we're going to do to everybody else. Why would it be different? And so in recognizing how strong those deep tendencies are and inclinations, how they keep appearing in the midst of our heartfelt, sincere efforts, makes us more tender, more gentle, more understanding, more compassionate. Doesn't let us off the hook. We're still accountable, but without ill will. And that's then what we can bring to others. Intimacy. Dijang asked a student, asked Fayan, where are you going? And Fayan said, on a pilgrimage. Dijang, what's the purpose of your pilgrimage? And Fayan said, I don't know. And Dijang said, this not knowing is intimate. A student once asked Master Dongshan, among the various bodies of the Buddha, which is the one that is free of any category? And Dongshan said, I'm always close to this. I'm intimate with this. Yangshan, Master Yangshan, once asked a student, where have you just come from? And the student said, from Mount Lu. And Yangshan said, did you visit the Five Elders Peak on Mount Lu? And the student says, no, I didn't get there. And Yangshan said, you didn't visit that mountain at all. In a certain way, we can say that all the teachings and all of our practice is about bringing us closer. In the first moment we take our seat, we turn inward, we settle, become still, and begin to see and hear and taste and touch and smell and think mindfully. We're coming closer. When we struggle in our zazen, which is a universal experience, remember that, it's not just you. And the greater that struggle is, that's showing us the greater the distance there is between us and whatever we're struggling with, some aspect of ourselves. When that struggle begins to abate, calm, become less and less frequent, that distance is beginning to come closer. That's what's happening. And that's true, and it's also a kind of an illusion. When you look at something, do your eyes go towards the object? Does the object come to your eyes? When you hear something, does your ear go out and approach the sound? The mind doesn't go far away. It doesn't come closer. And yet, something's changing. Something is changing. There is a sense of distance. Very often students will come in and say, I feel very close. They are experiencing something. And that's true, and it's also not entirely true. They're not coming closer. What is coming closer? It's a sense of something. But it's not a thing. So it might be a sense that some boundary is becoming more diffuse or falling away, that some screen between ourselves and something else is falling away. There's a truth to that. We are experiencing these changes. When we practice by bringing that kind of attention into what our walking, our bowing, our chanting, our sitting, things do become more immediate, right? We do have that experience. And that's communicated, that's evidence. Right? You are in the midst of an experiment that has been conducted thousands and thousands and thousands of times over thousands of years. And evidence is coming to you and confirming, affirming that the basis of that experiment, you are perfectly complete. Nothing is outside. Nothing outside is ultimately going to satisfy you. You must find it here. the evidence of the truth of that is starting to come through. Mazuma Roshi said, relating this to yourself, you can see how you can pursue your life. Whatever practice you're involved in, whatever work you're doing, just reading my words right now or looking at the photographs in the book that this Genjo Koan was printed in. Absorb yourself totally into this with your whole body and mind. Just continue in this way, and when the time comes, you will see that which is true. Your very life is the life of the enlightened one, the Buddha. It said, because it is so very close, it's hard to see. Because it's so close. You know, if you came in and we said, okay, enlightenment is 100 miles away, 1,000 miles away, you'd be on it. Right? We'd know what to do. We'd give you a map, you'd get there. But when we come in and say, no, you came with it, it's like, what? I love the idea of that, but I just don't believe it. Right? How could that be true? Given my experience, the evidence of what I'm experiencing. Well, that is the evidence. I am experiencing the evidence of a life based in separation, based in the sense that I am something that is fixed and permanent, based in the sense that everything that is outside of me is distinctly and independently not me. I am experiencing the evidence of that. We are experiencing right now, more than we need, the evidence of what happens when we are lost to ourselves, when that fundamental intimacy, which is already present within all of us, gets more and more lost, when the distance becomes more and more profound. We become dangerous. We are not only in danger, but we create danger. We are not only have the capacity to hurt ourselves, we are hurting ourselves. And we are hurting other people. And the graver those actions are showing us the depth and the breadth and the strength and the solidity and the, you know, of the delusion. It's the evidence. Past and future thinking, worry and anxiety, planning, preparing, these are so deeply ingrained in us. We call it distraction. You know, distraction is kind of a benign, oh, I'm distracted, right? Planes fall from the sky. Cars crash into bridges, right? Mistakes are made in surgery. Children are not listened to. A loved one is not taken care of, right? We miss a moment. T.S. Eliot said, we find ourselves distracted from distraction by our distraction. The Roman philosopher Seneca said, to be everywhere in distractedness is to be nowhere. And that's why the evidence of that is it's not satisfying. We can be doing so many good things and be so unfulfilled. Feel unfulfilled. And that's evidence of something. But to just totally absorb ourselves in with the whole body and mind, that's not a rule. Or better, maybe more accurate to say, that needs to manifest in different ways. Because when we hear that, we can sort of think, okay, I need to kind of disappear with the whole body and mind into this one visual object, or this one sound, or the breath, or my awareness, or the koan. And lose any sense of outside awareness. There are such moments. We call it samadhi. But samadhi is not a fixed thing, right? There is nothing that has one form. And so there is single-pointed concentration or samadhi, but sometimes that same concentration is very expansive. It's very large, spacious. When you're driving a car, right? You want to have a larger awareness, right? You keep the eyes right in front of you, but you need to be aware of what's happening. What's happening in front of you, what's happening behind you, what's happening over here. Our mind is perfectly, brilliantly built to be able to do that, to have a spacious alertness, awareness, responsiveness. When we're walking along a busy street, there are other moments where you can be just completely present in one thing. That's what Sesshin provides, basically, most of the time, is an opportunity to, you only have to take care of one thing. If you're on the subway, you need to know when your stop comes, right? When I was in the city, some students who commuted would talk about how they would do Zazen on the train, right? Because they would have a long commute. I said, well, that's good. That's a good way of using that time. But it's not the same as when you sit at home or you sit on the here in the Zendo, because you have to maintain some awareness of where you are, right? You just naturally will, because you're in the midst of other people, but also you know, need to know when to get off. And that's in your mind. When you're at home, you don't need that awareness, right? You set an alarm, so you don't need to think when it's 30 minutes or 45 minutes or 60 minutes or 10 minutes up. You can let go of that so that all of your attention with the whole body and mind goes into this one thing. If you're sitting at home alone and you have a child or somebody you're caring for and they may call out for you, then there's a part of your mind that needs to be open to that, right? So there's still samadhi, but there needs to be some space. Monitors sit this way. Their job is to do Zazen. They need to be doing Zazen. But their job is actually to take care of all of you so that you don't have to worry about it. So if you hear a sound or somebody comes up in the door or something needs to be attended to, that's not your job. Your job is just sit, so you can sit with the whole body and mind. They sit with the whole body and mind and with an ear. Right? I was thinking about two students that I knew who were married years ago, and they told me he was intensive care for pediatrics, and he had a pager. So every night when he went to bed, when he was on duty, he had the pager. And they had just had a young child who was in the crib in the room next door. And she told me that when the pager went off, he would be up like that. She would sleep right through it. When her daughter would go, oh, she would be up and he would sleep right through it. So the mind has that capacity to be completely present and be available. How wonderful. It's really like just knowing what is needed in any given moment, because mind, awareness, concentration has no fixed form. That doesn't mean it's anything. Buddhism is quite specific, very particular about describing what it is, these various states of concentration and how they develop, how mindfulness develops into concentration. We might think those are the same. They're not. That's why they are presented as two different stages of the Eightfold Path. And Yasutani Roshi said something interesting about this. He said, between completely mustering the whole body and mind to see forms and hear sounds, and intimately perceiving, to have insight into that intimate experience of unity, of no separation, he said, there is a subtle turning point. The two are not the same, although they're clearly related. And so to see forms with the whole body and mind, to experience them intimately, he's saying there's actually a turning point. They're not exactly the same. Hearing sounds with the whole body and mind doesn't mean that necessarily we will have insight, an intimate encounter with that. Although that whole body and mind experience opens the door wide to that experience. If it were just about sitting with the whole body and mind, and that was all that was needed, then we would just focus on concentration. Mindfulness in the early teachings has the quality of great appreciation, which I really like. To be mindful of something is to have great appreciation for that one thing. Think about when you're speaking to somebody about something and they give you your whole attention. right? It feels good. It feels like you're being appreciated, that what you're saying is being heard, matters to them, that they're giving you that time. You are worthy of that. It's a way of loving someone, of expressing compassion for them. And yet, it's so simple. Concentration has the aspect of apprehending correctly. That is that mindfulness, which is just holding the object in our mind and seeing it, right? As that deepens into concentration, it blends or evolves into seeing the thing more and more clearly as it is. And so think about what's going on right now, right? Where we have created all of these ways of mass producing delusion, lies, deceptions, right? And we're producing more with AI. I mean, are we really smart enough to be managing, to be actually be bringing this into the world? Have we shown ourselves to be smart enough and responsible enough and to know enough about what we're about and what we're doing? I would leave that as an open question. What does the evidence show us? As with many things, we can do some good, right? And that's usually what's lauded. Yeah, but we can do all this good. That's true. And are we smart enough, wise enough, to actually just live this life? Yeah, we are. Fundamentally, that's what the Buddha realized. Too often, we just don't do, we don't live that. And so concentration has that quality of apprehending correctly, and that in it, the early teachers say, it makes your mind and body serviceable. Right? You can use it. It makes it available to your mind and your body in more and more of its full capacity, its full potential, so that you can use it. For what purpose? For good. It's not that complicated. For good. To do something good. To do something that is beneficial. For whom? For anyone. For everyone. In what direction? Any direction. What about when no one's there? Do it for whatever's there. It's a way of being. It's a way of being in the world. Now we can fulfill our aspirations. Now we can actually not just have an intention, but live it. You know, when the mind and body are not that serviceable, we can dream up incredible worlds, right? We can have amazing, wonderful, brilliant, sublime aspirations, but it's going to be very hard to live them, to fulfill them for a day, for an hour, for a moment. Not because we don't have that capacity, not because that ability is somehow outside of us. It's not. It'll never be outside of us. But because our aspiration needs to be met with what we can actually do, and that's what practice is. We actually do the thing. That's why I say there's nothing theoretical about this. It's a living, it's not really even an experiment because it's been proven. Well, actually, maybe, I guess, you know, because scientifically you need to repeat experiments, verify them. So for one person to say, I did this experiment and this is what I discovered, it's like, well, that sounds great, but can that be repeated? That has to happen for that to become credible. Well, it has actually. And yet, Dogen says, it is not like a mirror with reflections, nor like the water under the moon, this intimacy, this mind and body unified. When one side is realized, the other side is dark. And Maizumi Roshi says that the metaphor of the moon is used in a later section of the Genjo Koan in a different way. But here, he says, it's not like the water, like a mirror with reflections, like the water under the moon, because this whole sense of object and subject have disappeared. The whole sense of division, that's the intimacy. There is no such object, no such true self, no such moon outside of ourselves to be reflected. Nothing exists but that moon, and that is who we are. When we call it the moon, we ourselves disappear. There's just moon. When we call it myself, the moon disappears. When there is just this true self, this one reality, nothing else exists beside that. And that includes everything. So when he says nothing else exists, everything that is, he means nothing else exists outside of this. And so think about, we practice with the breath, we go into the breath, it becomes more and more intimate, the gap starts to close. Self-awareness, self-consciousness drops away more and more. There are more moments where that's occurring. There's more sustained moments of mindfulness, moments where concentration appears and becomes more, we are more apprehending correctly. And then we shift towards what we call being the breath, which again is true and false. True because it is a practice where you try and become more aware of the subtle aspects, the more subtle aspects in which that sense of division or distance is present. Your mind's not moving, nothing actively, or there's no object there, but there's a subtle sense that something's still separating you. What is that? It's not a thing. So then how do you let go more completely into the breath when there is no thing to let go of? Only you can know. And so for your practice to be being the breath is all that we can say. You realize that. You show yourself what that is. You give yourself the evidence of that. And in that, there's just the breath. The breather, the sense of self, the sitter, the meditator, the one developing, that drops away. And in that, nothing is lacking. And there's only the breath. Seeing forms with the whole body and mind, we understand them intimately. And when one side is realized, the other side is dark. Lhasa Rinpoche says, this means that when one side contains everything, there's no confusion, there's no duality. When one side is light, there's only light. When one side is dark, there's only dark. It's so hard for us to think of that with language, because language means when it's dark and it's not light. That's what dark means. And that's why we will never figure this out. No one has ever figured this out, not even the Buddha. It's not like that. Dharma Rinpoche used to say, it's not like something. And so that's why we come to the cushion, right? To let go of that particular aspect of mind, blessed that it is, right? It's amazing, but it's limited. He says, usually dark has a sense of delusion, but here it rather has a sense of all-inclusive. When we realize one side, now we're able to function quite freely in the realm of the whole, which that Master Dogen calls dark. Actually, whether we call it light or dark, doesn't really matter. Because one, being one with whatever we are doing, wherever we are right now, washing the dishes, listening to the sounds of the birds, that is our whole life right here, right now. Every other life apart from that is theoretical. And so when we're sitting down and planning a trip, right, the trip itself, as an idea, is theoretical. The planning is not. The plan is planning is happening right here. But what the trip will be doesn't exist. If I think about the trip and start to make that real in my mind, now I'm in the realm of theory and imagination and fantasy and so on. I plan so that I can embark on that trip and have some sense of my direction, and then be in that, appreciating it, experiencing it correctly. This side, that side, this perspective, that perspective, your belief, my belief. We have them, we need them, we use them, often not so well. More often we're used by them, or we use them against ourselves and others. A belief doesn't have the power to do anything by itself. But they are different. They have the same nature. They're all empty. They don't exist as any fundamental truth. There is no truth in that sense. Just somewhere in the world can you get to it. So that's why we speak more in terms of reality, the way things actually are. In our world, this planet, this universe, this body as a human being, this body and mind. And that's why we can't take a belief away from somebody. Where is it? I mean, if it was in their pocket, you could steal it. It's not a thing. We can't take it away from somebody. We can't make them not hold on to it. Ultimately, only each of us can ourselves liberate ourselves from anything that we are holding on to. But we can be encouraged to do that. We can see that the evidence of holding on to that is actually causing me and others suffering. In order to see that, I have to care enough. What happens when I don't? I'm in trouble. You're in trouble. You can't make somebody care. So what happens when there are people in great power who don't care or care about things that are woefully misguided? We're in trouble. That's what happens. We suffer, others suffer. And as practitioners, that's the reality that appears before us. And we can think from now until the end of time, this should not be, this does not have to be. I mean, that's the most painful thing of all. But it is. Today. That's what we know. It's today. Tomorrow? Don't know. We're not completely in the blind on that, but we don't actually know. Or tomorrow's tomorrow. Or that tomorrow's tomorrow. We don't know. We had a meeting on the other day about the beyond fear of differences and how to, where we are, where are we now with that in terms of developing, moving that forward. What is the medicine of that that's needed now within our community and also just within the world, given what's happening? And I told the story of having just listened to a talk by Robert Thurman, who was talking about the Dalai Lama. He was the Dalai Lama's first monk and has been very close with him all these years. And he said, the Dalai Lama says that when he's overwhelmed by grief and despair, which just right there gets our attention, right? So that someone of his wisdom, of his compassion, right, has moments, right, where he perhaps feels overwhelmed. I don't know, right? I'm just basing it on those words. But where perhaps he feels overwhelmed by grief, by despair, he would certainly have reason for that. And that what helps him, the medicine for that, is compassion. That he spent his whole life cultivating compassion. He knows how to do that. He knows deeply how to do that. He knows the source of that. May all beings be free of suffering and know the root of their suffering. He knows the root of that suffering within himself and within others. And when he falls into despair, and now I'm putting words in his mind and mouth, but forgive me for that. He understands. He has a capacity to see in the moment that that's what's happening. And so he does not need to ignore, deny that despair, but he also knows this also. There's a truth to this, and it's also an illusion. And he's dedicated his life, and the evidence demonstrates that, to moving forward from that. And that's just a profound and very simple example of this path. And in that, he is not mired. He's moving. He's being a benefit. He's bringing something forward. He's creating something today, something that is needed. And isn't that our place? our place of strength, of capacity, of power. And that is an antidote to moments where we might feel helpless or hopeless. And so there are such moments. Even Avalokiteshvara, on a bad day, her head exploded. Right? So even she has bad days. I find a strange kind of comfort in that. Right? So it's like if it happened to her, you know, I can have my moments. But I'm still stuck with just one head. She got some added on. Well, she has a much... She doesn't actually have a bigger job. We have the same job. So, I'm going to end with a few lines from The Faith Mind. Without boundary, you and another, and I would say you and I, Palestinians and Israelis, Russians, Ukrainians, white and black and brown, rich and poor, left and right, choose your particular group of categories. Without boundary, these are indistinguishable. They cannot exist without that boundary. And they contain the myriad phenomena. Not seeing finer course, how then can there be bias or faction? There cannot be. While a narrow view mistrusts and doubts and going more and more fast is always moving more and more slowly, all the while, this great way is essentially peaceful. And that great way is you and me and every blessed thing. And everything we call practice is to bring us closer.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.